Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. I'm Kara Keehan. Today we'll be discussing the recently published article titled Oxidative Damage in Neurodegeneration: Roles in the Pathogenesis and Progression of Alzheimer's Disease. This article published in the January 2024 issue of Physiological Reviews. Joining me today are Associate Editor Professor Giovanni Mann and authors Professor D. Allen Butterfield and Professor Marzia Perluigi. Let's learn more. Professor Mann, welcome.
Thank you very much. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you to this Physiological Reviews podcast. I'm Giovanni Mann. I'm the Associate Editor of Physiological Reviews, and today I have the personal great pleasure of hosting Professor D. Allen Butterfield and Professor Marzia Perluigi, who've contributed significantly to our understanding of the oxidative stress hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease. Their extensive Physiological Reviews article, entitled, as we've just heard, Oxidative Damage in Neurodegeneration: Roles in the Pathogenesis and Progression of Alzheimer's Disease, was published in January 2024. And I advise all listeners of this podcast to read that review, since it provides fantastic information on amyloid beta peptide-associated mechanisms, the use of redox proteomics to define roles of lipid and protein oxidation, and the antioxidant strategies that have been employed to modulate or even slow the progression of Alzheimer's, and above all, to improve the quality of life for individuals with a severe dementing disorder. Firstly, Allen Butterfield, you're a professor of biological chemistry at the College of Arts and Sciences and associate vice president for research at the University of Kentucky in the United States. Your laboratory first described how oxidative stress associated with amyloid beta peptide, a 42 amino acid peptide deposited in Alzheimer's brains, leads to neurotoxicity, and how various antioxidants can modulate or attenuate this oxidative stress and neuronal death. Moreover, your laboratory pioneered the application of redox proteomics to identify oxidatively modified brain proteins in the disease and other neurodegenerative disorders. Insights into the molecular basis for potential therapeutic intervention in age-related neurodegenerative disorders is envisaged, as highlighted in your article, for future research. Professor Butterfield has published 644 articles with an H-index of 126, that's in Scopus as of 8th of January 2024, with 57,777 citations by 33,152 documents. That is unbelievably commendable, Allen. Professor Marzia Perluigi is a professor of biochemical sciences in Sapienza University in Rome, Italy. Her research laboratory focuses on the defect of mitophagy and mitochondrial activity as essential determinants of Alzheimer's in Down syndrome strategies, as well as the role of aberrant insulin signaling in the development of Alzheimer's in Down syndrome. In her projects, Professor Perluigi is exploring potential drug targets and potential therapeutic strategies. Professor Perluigi has published 151 articles with an H-index of 54 as of 8th of January 2024, with 8,631 citations by 5,829 documents. Again, highly commended, Professor Perluigi, and I'm delighted to be hosting the podcast with both of you. To begin with, let's set the scene for our listening audience, and I am particularly keen to involve our early career researchers. I would appreciate if both of you could briefly review your research training and career, highlighting collaborations you've established with international laboratories, how the two of you got together, and what enabled you to develop such a fascination with Alzheimer's and the field of redox biology and chemistry associated with this disease. Over to you, Allen and Marzia.
First of all, I want to thank you, Professor Mann. for your kind remarks about me and Professor Pierluigi. It's an honor and a pleasure to be meeting you today on this podcast. My research career began as an undergraduate chemistry major at the University of Maine, the state in which I was reared. I was fascinated that a person could make a living by thinking, since in my first 2 years of university study, I worked on hard labor jobs to pay my tuition for these studies. Thinking and performing research certainly was much easier and highly rewarding for my role in science that I uncovered. Following a 3-year period of being a missionary in apartheid Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, where I, along with my wife, taught Africans who otherwise would not be taught, and in my case, mathematics and chemistry, I entered graduate studies in physical chemistry at Duke University, who had held my position for the 3 years we were in Africa. Fortunately, my graduate studies of membrane structure and function employing electron paramagnetic resonance all worked very well, and I was able to earn my PhD in a bit under 3 years, publishing 5 papers based on my dissertation research. I then wrote my first successful NIH grant for a postdoctoral fellowship, which I pursued in neurosciences at the Duke University School of Medicine. I then joined the Department of Chemistry at the University of Kentucky in the city of Lexington and immediately became friends with and started collaborating with Dr. William Marksberry, a world-renowned neuropathologist. He invited me to work on Alzheimer's disease and provided to me autopsy-obtained brain tissues from persons with AD and an equal number of age-matched control brains. UK has the fastest autopsy program in the United States, with less than 4 hours postmortem interval on average, and has the largest number of normal controls, approximately 600, who are followed yearly and who donate their brains immediately after death. Some of these people would have developed AD, and since we knew their complete history and their medical issues, this gives a big advantage for our UK investigators. This short postmortem interval also allows as close a possible examination of autopsied brain to living brain. And during this period, I asked the question of why there were so many different reports in the literature of altered protein and lipid composition and diminished functions. Why not just one change, like in sickle cell disease? So I had this hoped-for, once-in-a-career brainstorm of an idea while walking on the UK campus. What if there were a free radical associated with AD with whatever proteins and lipids the free radical, or more likely the free radical reaction products, reacted with to become oxidized, change their structure with consequent diminished function, thereby killing neurons and leading to dementia? So as you noted, Professor Mann, in my laboratory, which was populated by outstanding PhD students and postdoctoral scholars, first described the free radical associated with amyloid beta peptide and then reported the first evidence of oxidative damage of proteins and lipids in AD brain. Preclinical studies with neurons and animal model of AD, as well as patient specimens, helped drill down on specific proteins and lipids and the mechanisms of free radical damage in AD involving A beta and lipid peroxidation and protein oxidation. We also found these changes in an earlier stage of AD called mild cognitive impairment, suggesting oxidative damage occurred long before dementia developed. I was assisted very ably in these studies by Professor Pierluigi when she was a postdoctoral scholar in my laboratory. And later, 3 other graduate students or postdoctoral scholars from Sapienza University of Rome also subsequently studied in my laboratory. We can explore these findings further in this podcast. Marcia.
Oh, thank you, Cara and Professor Mann, for your kind introduction about me and Professor Butterfield. I'm really honored to join you today on this podcast. My research career began as an undergraduate pharmaceutical chemistry major at the University of Rome La Sapienza, the place I am currently full professor. During my early studies, I was mainly focused to become a very good pharmaceutical chemist and work in a company. But while joining the biochemistry lab to do my thesis project, I was fascinated by the bench, where you can challenge your research questions, your curiosity, your attitude, as well as your limits to add your piece to the puzzle. This meeting was a unique experience for me that in a short time, I changed my priority list and decided to join the PhD program in biochemistry at the Faculty of Medicine, under the supervision of an extraordinary professor and scientist, which made my first steps in science very tough. Since the beginning, I was trained in oxidative stress field, first in tumor biology and only later in brain physiopathology. I believe that at early career stage, you should ask yourself to be contaminated by people, by working in different labs and in different settings, and by science, by doing different projects and following experimental approaches. I did most of my training in Rome, but I was lucky to move in other labs to perform some of the experiments involved in my project. I began with in vitro study, performing HPLC analysis. Then I moved into cell biology, biochemistry, and later on, in vivo animal studies with rodent models. My PhD project was focused on tumor. During my postdoc training, I had the chance to learn about Alzheimer's disease when I joined Professor Butterfield Neurochemistry Lab. At the beginning, I was novel to the field, but being in such an exciting environment full of PhD students and postdoc, in a short time, I was contaminated by the enthusiasm of my colleagues and, of course, by the extraordinary mentoring by Professor Butterfield. I remember many of the discussions we had during lab meetings and in his office because he was always available to sit and talk with students. The privilege of being trained by such a great expert in the field of oxidative stress and Alzheimer's disease made the difference for my training and future career.
Thank you very much, Alan Butterfield and Marcia Pierluigi. It's been a pleasure listening to the development of your research careers. I think what I'd like to do now is briefly highlight just some of the international awards you have both received for our audience that's listening. Alan Butterfield, you have certainly been acknowledged for your innovative scientific work, and you were elected Fellow of the Society for Redox Biology and Medicine, SFRBM, in 2012, and you were awarded the 2013 Discovery Award from that same society for your seminal research on oxidative stress in Alzheimer's disease, and particularly your pioneering the field of redox proteomics. Both you and Marcia Pierluigi are amongst the top five researchers worldwide for studies of mechanisms of brain metabolism in Alzheimer's disease. And I was particularly moved by the fact that you, Alan Butterfield, received medals of excellence in science from Sapienza University of Rome and the University of Padua. Professor Marcia Pierluigi, you too have received numerous international awards from learned societies for innovative work. In 2012, you were the top young researcher in the Faculty of Medicine at the Sapienza University in Rome. And in 2019, you were the youngest female full professor of biochemistry in the Faculty of Medicine. To me, Marcia, this highlights the importance of young female scientists coming up in career and achieving full professorships, as you have done. I say that from a personal perspective, as I have two academic daughters, one in history and one in medical biosciences. In 2020, Marcia, you were among the top five most productive Italian biochemists, further underpinning the success of your career. What I'd like to do now is ask both of you for some further insight into how you manage your international link, not only the link between Rome and Kentucky, but also the established your successful collaboration leading to exchange visits between your two laboratories and others. For our early career investigators online, I feel it would be extremely valuable if you could highlight how did you initiate and maintain your early career as well as your current research links with colleagues in the US and elsewhere. Over to you, Alan and Marcia.
Thank you very much, Giovanni. So I sort of break my responses down into those three components of international early career and current collaborations in the United States. So internationally, I have international collaborators, including Professors Pierluigi, Fabio Di Domenico, Eugenio Barone, and Antonella Tramutola, all from the Sapienza University of Rome, each of whom spent at least 1 year in my laboratory, and all of whom performed exceptional research, since each is a highly skilled biochemist. They are also, this is very important, they are also exceptional people as well. I sent supplies and precious brain samples to their laboratory in Rome, which allowed them to carry out collaborative studies of our two laboratories. Because obtaining autopsy samples is a challenge in Italy, so I was able to have my laboratory in some ways expanded to the University of Rome. We have been collaborating for now for 20 years, as Marcia mentioned earlier. I have given seminars at Sapienza University of Rome, during which visits we plan our studies and papers going forward. And likewise, I had Professor Pierluigi as a major speaker at a 2023 conference that I organized at the University of Kentucky. And Professors Di Domenico, Barone, and Tramutola gave pre-conference presentations of their work we are doing together. We also occasionally have Zoom meetings to stay in touch. In a different collaboration internationally, I also wrote a paper on glucose dysmetabolism and oxidative stress in Alzheimer's disease that was published in Nature Reviews of Neuroscience with Professor Barry Hallowell at the National University of Singapore. Early in my career, I mentioned how I initiated my early career in neurodegenerative disorders by combining my research skills in membrane structure and function and EPR with collaborative studies with a world-class neuropathologist. Moreover, I recruited very talented, determined, and focused graduate students to my group. Their success led to other hardworking, highly motivated students joining my research group. Each student published at least twice the number of a typical PhD dissertation in chemistry in the United States, which together with my connections to the larger AD research community led to postdoctoral fellowships in very good laboratories, furthering the graduate students' careers. In total, I mentored 68 PhD and master students. And through their outstanding research, I was promoted to associate professor of chemistry with tenure in just under 3 years, and full professor 5 years later. And currently, I have collaborations with some of my former PhD students who are professors in other colleges and universities. And this has helped them, especially if they're in largely teaching universities, in writing papers together that has the benefit of to them of furthering their careers. Over to you, Marcia.
Oh, thank you, Professor Butterfield. So I have several international collaborations, among which my favorite and most productive is no doubt the one that I have with you. It started in 2004, and this coming February is my 20th anniversary of science and friendship with Professor Butterfield. By the time I came back in Rome, I was able to keep working on my collaborative project with Professor Butterfield by analyzing autopsy sample I received from University of Kentucky to identify oxidatively modified proteins in MCI and Alzheimer's samples. One powerful strategy has been to share my PhD students and junior postdoc that were all excited to join Professor Butterfield lab in Lexington. Let's say that by this way, I was able to grow my family in Rome while my students were moving to UK, and Zoom meetings allowed to share experiments and fruitful discussion among the two labs. I can say that after being a postdoc in 2004 and 5 at UK, my career at Sapienza University was strongly dictated by the huge number of papers I was able to publish on collected results on the role of oxidative stress in Alzheimer's disease and its preclinical stages, both in humans and animal models thereof. By this experience, I got the chance to work a lot with animal models, test drugs, do behavioral tests, and analyze postmortem brain with different experimental approaches. Everything was possible also because I met very nice students and researchers in the lab that, as Professor Butterfield mentioned, did a great job. I still keep collaborating with colleagues in the United States and many others in Europe, being involved both in neuroscience society as well as in the field of free radical biology and medicine. This is what I told you before, is the sense of contamination and how much you can learn from expert scientists out of your field.
Thank you very much, Alan and Marcia. I think what this underpins for our listeners is the importance of reaching out from one's own institution to colleagues both within the country and abroad. And you two have clearly shown the fascination for Alzheimer's and the dedication to develop a field so successfully, collaboratively, and at the same time, as you said, Marcia, exchanging families of students. I think that's really quite wonderful. I'd like to now ask you a more specific question about how did you sustain long-term funding for your research outputs from your laboratory? And what roles did you play initially or later in your career in national or scientific learned societies? And your role or involvement in grant review panels? I ask these questions specifically because I feel that as we develop as scientists, we play a greater and greater role in leading, influencing scientific learned societies and in fairly assessing grants applications that are submitted to grant review panels. For our early career listeners, could you just briefly highlight how and when in your career you became involved with a learned society, grant awarding panels, and whether you feel this experience has enhanced your career and your development in scientific thinking?
So this is my 49th year at the University of Kentucky. And I am proud to say, thanks to the wonderful people I've had in the lab, I have been funded that entire time by different agencies, mostly National Institutes of Health, but also National Science Foundation and various foundations. When you have as productive a lab as I've had because of people like Marcia who came to the lab, she was there for 1 year and managed to gather data to publish 11 papers. Does that say something about her talent? So I also have served as a permanent member of the Neural Oxidative Mechanisms of Death Study Section for the National Institutes of Health for 6 years, and I chaired that study section during that last year. For essentially all of my career, I've also served fairly often as an ad hoc reviewer for different NIH study sections, also chair of these panels. And I also have served as a reviewer for the National Science Foundation on several panels and as an ad hoc reviewer for grant proposals. And internationally, I served for more than 10 years as a member of the International Review Panel for the Center of Neurobiology of the National University of Singapore. And I served 7 years as a member of the International Review Panel for the Ministry of Education of the Government of Singapore for Basic Sciences and Engineering Grants, similar to NSF in the USA. And currently, I'm serving now, I think it's 7 or 8 years already, as a member of the International Review Panel for the Ministry of Health Grants on disease-related grant proposals, similar to the NIH in the United States. I was previously, or currently, am a member of the editorial boards of 15 journals, So the service on various review panels and editorial boards, as well as our own research, and as well as giving invited research presentations at national and international conferences, certainly have increased exposure of my laboratory's research.
So as you may know, the Italian grant funding rules are quite different from US. So it has been quite hard at the beginning to get good grants. And currently I'm quite proud to got grants, may say more from international grant panels like the Alzheimer's Association and the Jerome Lejeune Foundation, in addition to the Italian grants. I'm current reviewer for the Italian National Research Programs involving different goals along the years. And internationally, I also served for the Alzheimer's Association initiating grants for some European funding agency in Spain, France, and Portugal, and also for the Israeli Ministry of Health. My grant review activities significantly raised were after I became associate professor, maybe according to the consolidation of my laboratory research, which I believe has become quite well known in the field of oxidative stress, energy metabolism, and protostasis in Alzheimer's neurodegeneration.
Thank you very much, Alan and Marcia. I think for our listeners, I'd like to add one sentence. When you're young and early in your career, you want to go to the bench, do the science, write the papers, and have them published. And you find it really irritating when senior mentors suggest to you, you might want to review this paper or sit on this panel or that panel. But as you mature and possibly come out of the lab a little, you find how important it is to contextualize the research questions you have in light of what is being done in the literature, not taking ideas from others, but actually understanding the difficulty of writing a clear story, getting the funding, writing reports on the funding. And I would commend all young people to follow the path that Alan and Marcia have so elegantly described to us. But now let's turn to science. And really, further to your review article published in Physiological Reviews, I wonder if you could highlight the critical importance of oxidative stress in the pathogenesis of Alzheimer's, and whether you could provide us with some insight into the timeline and the sources of reactive oxygen species, and which in particular you feel contributes primarily to redox distress as described by Helmut Sies in Alzheimer's. Over to you, Alan and Marcia.
Our research has shown that small oligomers of A-beta led to oxidative stress and neuronal death to neurons in both culture models and animal models of Alzheimer's disease, as of course in patients as well. In order to really answer the question you posed, I have to give a small tutorial on free radical chemistry that will help the listener understand how oxidative stress kills neurons. As small oligomers, hydrophobic A beta inserts into the neuronal lipid bilayer, which, like almost all peptides and proteins that traverse the lipid bilayer, adopt an alpha helical secondary conformation. And alpha helices are known to have every fourth amino acid interact with each other in proteins. We showed that when a helix breaking proline amino acid is substituted for isoleucine, four amino acids to the N-terminal side of the single key redox active methionine residue at position 35 of the 42 amino acid A-beta, these A-beta oligomers no longer could stabilize the helix dipole facilitated stabilization of a free radical that occurs on the methionine S atom that would otherwise attack and remove labile allylic hydrogen atoms on an unsaturated fatty acid of a phospholipid, which is the very first step in lipid peroxidation process, as I will describe momentarily. Moreover, our laboratory showed that if in an AD mouse model, which is called the J20 mouse, with two mutations in the human transgene for amyloid precursor protein, or APP, which is the source of A-beta, is given a third mutation of on this APP, specifically substituting the codon for methionine residue that corresponds to the key methionine residue of A beta, substituted that by leucine, the resulting A beta peptide without this key methionine, but an A beta that still forms alpha helices upon solubilization in the lipid bilayer as small oligomers, we found no oxidative stress occurs in the brains of a one-year-old mouse, in sharp contrast to the elevated oxidative stress and damage of the original J20 mouse that had the methionine in A beta. So redox proteomics also demonstrated a significant diminution in the number of oxidized proteins found in the brains of these third mutated mouse. These results demonstrate that the single methionine amino acid in A beta is key to the oxidative stress involving this neurotoxic peptide. How this occurs is related to the alpha helical secondary structure of small oligomers. Namely, the peptide backbone oxygen atom of isoleucine at residue 31 is known to be folded to within 3.7 angstroms, in other words, a van der Waals distance, of the S atom of methionine 35. And oxygen has a stronger electron affinity than does the sulfur atom. Therefore, lone pair electrons on the sulfur atom are drawn away a short distance from the pull of the S atom protons in its nucleus and toward the oxygen on isoleucine 31. And this makes this lone pair of electrons less tightly held by the S atom of methionine and more susceptible to a one electron oxidation of these S electrons, forming a transient S plus dot free radical, which is called a sulfuranyl free radical. And because the A beta oligomer is in the bilayer, the sulfuranyl free radical is adjacent to very labile allylic hydrogen atoms on allylic carbons of unsaturated fatty acids in the phospholipid bilayer. The sulfuranyl free radical abstracts a labile hydrogen atom from an allylic carbon atom, forming SH plus acid on methionine and a carbon-centered free radical on the fatty acid. Molecular oxygen is highly abundant in lipid bilayers since, as a homonuclear diatomic molecule, it has a zero dipole moment and therefore is soluble in hydrophobic materials like phospholipids. But it does have oxygen does have two unpaired electrons. And because radical-radical recombination reactions are so fast, one electron on molecular oxygen binds to the unpaired electron on the allylic carbon atom from which the allylic hydrogen atom was abstracted, forming a lipid peroxyl free radical. This latter then can abstract a different allylic hydrogen atom from an unsaturated fatty acid of the phospholipids in the neuronal membrane lipid bilayer, forming a lipid hydroperoxide and another carbon-centered free radical. The lipid hydroperoxide can decompose spontaneously to a 9-carbon alpha-beta unsaturated aldehyde called 4-hydroxynonenal, or HNE. And more on HNE in just a moment. The second carbon-centered free radical undergoes molecular oxygen addition to form a new lipid peroxyl radical and then a lipid hydroperoxide, as I described, which again forms HNE. And these steps involved in formation of the lipid hydroperoxide is what is known in chemistry as a chain reaction that will continue to run as long as there are molecular oxygen and allylic hydrogen atoms on unsaturated fatty acids present. This means that only a small amount of the original radical on the S atom of methionine leads to a huge amplification of neurotoxic HNE. In the meantime, the original SH plus acid that was formed on methionine has a high tendency to lose this H plus because it has a pKa of -5. It loses this to any base, leading to formation of methionine once again. So this type of reaction in chemistry, in which one reactant takes part in the reaction and in so doing is reconverted to itself, is called a catalytic reaction. So A-beta small oligomers solubilized in the neuronal lipid bilayer produce copious amounts of neurotoxic H&E following lipid peroxidation reactions and does so by catalytic chain reactions. The H&E covalently binds to important membrane proteins, proteins involved in glycolysis, TCA cycle, and another key mitochondrial enzyme, ATP synthase, as well as numerous other proteins in several different pathways via a process called Michael addition. And in each case, H&E covalent binding causes structural changes in the proteins and a consequent diminution of enzymatic function. Much lower glucose utilization, demonstrated clinically in AD patients via PET scans for glucose utilization, that leads to the loss of the maintenance of a voltage difference across the neuronal membrane, which in turn leads to uncontrolled opening of voltage-gated calcium channels that ultimately leads to the death of neurons. Now, Professor Paraluigi will discuss other mechanisms of neuronal death in AD discovered by our collaborative research together.
Thank you, Professor Butterfield. The trajectory of redox distress in living subjects along life is quite challenging, considering also physiological adaptation. So identifying the threshold as a quantitative measure of what is the extent of toxic auxiliary damage in blood, tissue, or cells is far from being identified and should be the goal for future studies. However, due to the high oxygen consumption and high membrane content in polyunsaturated fatty acid, the brain is particularly susceptible to free radical damage, thus contributing to neurodegeneration, as already pointed by Professor Butterfield, with a view of lipid peroxidation and H&E toxic damage. It is likely that DP peroxidation is among the initiating toxic events, with amyloid small oligomers reactive with membrane lipids that in turn target other cellular components such as proteins and nucleic acid. Oxidative modification of protein, lipids, and nucleic acid mainly results in irreversible modification and consequent impairment of function, leading to disturbance of a plethora of cellular processes. In my opinion, oxidative stress should not be considered as a single event itself, but within the complexity of reaction and signaling cascade in which oxidative damage takes part. This integrated view emerges from extensive studies that led to the identification of the most relevant redox-regulated brain dysfunction that strongly contribute to the neurodegenerative process, and how these alterations translate into a clinical phenotype, which I mean cognitive decline, including MCI or late-stage AD. To describe the cellular background of cognitive decline, various aspects come into the picture that seem to drive the age-dependent reduction of cognitive abilities. Oxidative stress and its associated damage, changes in energy metabolism, epigenetic alteration, the gradual loss in repairing mechanism, all of which accompany brain dysfunction, should be considered. In particular, this latter, which involves the activity of UPS, the ubiquitin proteasome system, and autophagy, are central to avoid the intracellular accumulation of oxidized misfolded proteins. Our collaborative project between UK and Rome labs contributed to better understand the role of dysfunctional autophagy in Alzheimer's dementia. Autophagy, a process of removing damaged or aggravated proteins or organelles, is greatly compromised in Alzheimer's and MCI brain, as shown by Dr. Nixon. The resulting accumulation of detritus in neurons causes neuronal death. Our laboratory studies the mTOR pathway, which is normally quiescent but is aberrantly regulated in Alzheimer's disease. Activation of mTOR leads to inhibition of autophagy and to insulin resistance. Other reports that in a D, amyloid beta would activate mTOR via phosphorylation of key components of the PI3 kinase AKT pathway of mTOR activation. We confirmed this finding in brains of Alzheimer's patients, and we further demonstrated for the first time that the PI3K AKT pathway for activation of mTOR was operative in MCI brain as well, with decreased autophagy and increased insulin resistance markers. These latter results inconsistent with the notion that activation of mTOR is an early event in the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you very much for that very detailed and very interesting overview of the role that oxidative stress plays in the pathogenesis of AD. May I just ask perhaps a naive question, and that is, what is the role of astrocytes, which we know are protecting neurons from cell death, in the consequence or in the pathogenesis of AD? Is anything known about dysfunction or dysregulation of astrocyte neuronal contact or crosstalk?
Actually, there is quite a bit of work known, probably more in microglia than astrocytes, but still both. When activated, of course, they will emit molecules like iNOS to induce nitric oxide, which we'll be talking about later, and cytokines that are taken up by neurons to their detriment. And that can definitely lead to a neuronal death through an inflammatory sort of pathway, secondary to other processes like oxidative damage. In any case, astrocytes, yes, they are very metabolically active. They're especially important in glutamate, right? Because after glutamate is used as a neurotransmitter, it's taken up normally by astrocytes to remove excess glutamate from the synapse, because otherwise it would constantly depolarize the postsynaptic neuron, leading to what is a condition called excitotoxicity. And so here's what we discovered, was that HNE binds to and inactivates the glutamate uptake molecule or transporter called EAAT2. It's the excitatory amino acid transporter 2 that normally takes glutamate from the synapse into the astrocyte. But because HNE has damaged that transporter in astrocytes, it is absolutely not able to do that. And the glutamate then raises havoc with the postsynaptic neurons and can cause them to die.
Very interesting. Thank you, Alan. Let us turn now to another subject, as you highlighted in your review. That's the role that reactive nitrogen species, including nitric oxide, play in reacting with cysteines causing S-nitrosylation. Now, there is evidence, as you well know, that NO is involved in neuroinflammation and the progression of AD. Do you feel that nitric oxide and reactive nitrogen species are playing critical roles in the pathogenesis of Alzheimer's? And what are the key pathways that are being targeted? I'd value your opinion.
Thank you very much for that question, Giovanni. And as you know, neuronal NOS activity produces NO in the brain, and it's crucial and critical for neuronal function. But when there is also activation of inducible nitric oxide synthase, such as in microglia, upon activation from various stressors, the level of nitric oxide becomes high. Nitric oxide is a free radical, which in the presence of superoxide free radical, mostly from mitochondrial leaking, extremely fast radical-radical recombination takes place, producing the non-radical molecule called peroxynitrite, ONOO-. And through a series of reactions, peroxynitrite is decomposed to nitrogen dioxide, which is a free radical itself. In the presence of a free radical attack on the hydroxyl functionality of tyrosine, an oxygen-centered free radical is delocalized to the 3 position of tyrosine, and that free radical on the tyrosine 3 position reacts with nitrogen dioxide, a free radical, in a radical-radical recombination reaction to produce 3 nitrotyrosine. This is one of the main markers of nitrosative stress. And the steric hindrance inherent in the structure of 3 nitrotyrosine by the NO2 group decreases ease of tyrosine kinase facilitated phosphorylation of the tyrosine hydroxyl group in the 4 position, thereby decreasing intracellular signaling associated with substrate binding to plasma membrane receptors. And a good example of how tyrosine nitration can affect enzyme activity in Alzheimer's brain and mild cognitive impairment brain is our laboratory's discovery that the enzyme biliverdin reductase A is highly nitrated on tyrosine residues in these two conditions, and thereby decreasing the ability of BVRA from regulating insulin signaling, leading eventually to insulin resistance and neuronal death. So nitric oxide, upon processing further, can bind to the S atom of cysteine, as you mentioned. That's been demonstrated initially by Stuart Lipton, and thereby blocking the oxidation states of cysteine, for example, sulfenic acid, sulfinic acid, or sulfonic acid. And this, in turn, can cause various intercellular signaling pathways that involve reversible oxidation and reduction reactions of cysteine and decrease the activity of any enzymes with an active site cysteine. Therefore, to your point, Giovanni, for sure, RNS-mediated damage is prominent in brains of persons with AD and its earlier stage MCI.
As Professor Butterfield nicely illustrated, the 3NT modification on proteins is among the irreversible oxidative post-translational modification that affects protein function. This mechanism contributes to affect the activity of many metabolic enzymes with cysteine residues in their active site. As we discussed, 3NT is a specific marker of protein nitration by peroxynitrate produced by nitric oxide and superoxide. So, not surprisingly, modification of complex 1 subunits by 3NT of ATP synthase alpha chain and the voltage-dependent anion channel protein 1, VDAC, were identified in the brain from AD patients, thus suggesting that dysfunction of mitochondria plays a crucial role during Alzheimer's. Further, increased nitric oxide production is associated with neuroinflammation, a key molecular signature of degenerating brain. In Alzheimer's, the brain's microglia and astrocytes, which are normally responsible for maintaining the homeostasis of synaptic transmission and its remodeling by pruning, are the initiator of neuroinflammation and toxic tau and amyloid beta accumulation. Thus, they drive the central nervous system into a state of sustained or even self-accelerated deterioration. We suggest a crosstalk between oxidative stress and neuroinflammation that further contribute to amplify the cascade of events, ultimately leading to neuronal death. This notion is also confirmed by the fact that treatment with antioxidant compounds in rodent models of Alzheimer's were able to prevent accumulation of oxidative damage as well as neuroinflammation. And let me add just a few words about your previous question, Giovanni, about the role of astrocytes, which now are becoming central to sustain the oxidative metabolism of neurons. As you know, the oxidation of glucose into pyruvate is further metabolized into lactate, which is transported out and taken up by neurons, which further metabolize lactate back into pyruvate and the rest of TCA and oxophos. So I strongly believe that dysfunction of astrocytes would affect this lactate shunt, which in turn would affect and disturb the oxidative metabolism of neurons. And also, we know that precursor for glutathione synthesis occurring both in astrocytes and neurons anyway can be affected as well, because our astrocytes to give the precursor for glutathione synthesis to neurons. So I would like to stress these aspects of metabolism of astrocytes, which is very important to affect neuronal homeostasis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you. Since Alzheimer's is a multifactorial disease involving many pathways due to secondary oxidative modification of proteins and signaling pathways that you highlight in your review, I wonder if you could just give me some brief further comment on the limitations of a single target approach in patients suffering from the disease.
Sure enough. And as you correctly state, Giovanni, AD is a multifactorial disorder in terms of the symptoms that appear and the pathology that it's observed. That stated, however, one potential unifying mechanism for many of the functionally deficient pathways of proteins, lipids, and organelles is oxidative modification of all of these moieties. Our laboratories pioneering the methods of redox proteomics identified oxidatively modified and therefore dysfunctional brain proteins, sometimes as a result of lipid peroxidation, as I mentioned earlier. They're consistent with the observations that we observed, and they certainly are consistent with the symptoms and pathology seen in both MCI and AD. And while there may be ways to treat various moieties that are dysfunctional in AD, this would be a very highly complex pharmacological approach. In contrast, if there were a common mechanism by which all of these moieties became dysfunctional, targeting that mechanism or mechanisms at many points within the mechanism might prove to be more effective in treating AD and especially MCI patients. Our paper in the January 2024 issue of Physiological Reviews that you noted earlier outlines the evidence and rationale to underline such an approach that I just outlined.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Let me ask you now, if relevant at all, do you feel your research findings have benefited patients in early, mid, and late stages of Alzheimer's disease? And my secondary question is, have clinical trials highlighted recently benefits or deficits of specific drugs and or nutraceuticals?
Well, based on what I described previously in this podcast, I suggest that targeting the processes of small oligomer formation, or at least capturing these small oligomers by antibodies that would lead to their destruction, would significantly slow, if not retard, the progression of MCI to AD. Alternatively, disrupting any key step in the mechanisms of lipid peroxidation in brains of AD patients also likely would prevent a key oxidative stress-induced process of inactivating protein function and thereby the functions of various critical pathways, again, slowing the progression towards dementia. And a third approach could use the mTORC1 inhibiting agents that Marcia mentioned, that pathway, that were well tolerated over a long time period for MCI patients to modulate loss of autophagy and to slow one major cause of insulin resistance. So most patients and their families with whom I've met indicate they could live with some memory loss as long as they did not devolve into the state of dementia before normal causes of death occurred. In other words, they're willing to be a little bit affected by memory loss that you might see in MCI, but people with MCI have normal activities of daily living, and they know who people are, who are around them. When they're demented, and this is the thing that most AD families tell me, the patient feels great fear of having Alzheimer's disease because at the time of their death, they will not know the loved ones who are around them. And to address your questions of clinical trials and effective use of drugs in AD, targeting oligomers of A-beta, is the mechanism actually by which lecanemab, I think is the way it's pronounced, leads to the first disease-modifying drug treatment in AD. But as I think people know, this agent is not without serious side effects in some people. Therefore, targeting small oligomers of A-beta would be a much preferred approach, since the lecanemab only binds to larger oligomers, which will take, if to get it to the smaller oligomers, some drug that will bind to and inhibit smaller oligomers like dimers or trimers, this will take a considerable amount of pharmacological research. The Physiological Review paper has quite a lot of information about antioxidant-based clinical trials in it, and I refer people to that to gain more information.
Using antioxidants to treat the development of Alzheimer's may have consequences on, as you well know, NRF2 redox control. If we remove the signaling role of free radicals, we prevent tissues and cells having a sufficient amount of NRF2 activation to protect against heightened oxidative stress. So that's a thought. Marcia, if I could turn to you and ask you perhaps to comment a little bit further on the relationship between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease for our audience.
Oh, yes, I will be pleased to tell you some of recent research on Down syndrome neuropathology. So we know that accumulating evidence in the field of aging and neurodegeneration highlights several common molecular pathways among brain disorder. Thus, we are continuously learning by published studies on different neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson, ALS, Huntington, and Down syndrome, my current main research focus. Why I'm asking the complexity of Down syndrome neuropathology, because as you know, Down syndrome is the most common genetic form of intellectual disability that results from the triplication of the entire portion of part of the chromosome 21. And among the common, more severe traits, Down syndrome individuals are characterized by a number of dysmorphic future cardiac defects, but mostly by accelerated aging and cognitive impairment, including development of early onset Alzheimer's disease. Thus, Down syndrome represents a unique population for looking at the trajectory of brain aging across the lifespan that ultimately results in neurodegeneration. By the age of 40s, neuropathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's significantly accumulate, as indicated by widespread deposition of senile plaques and neurofibrillary tangles many years before diagnosis of dementia. To understand the strong association between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's neuropathology, the first insight is given by interrogating the chromosome 21, in which the overexpression of selected gene has already been identified to be involved in the onset of Alzheimer's neuropathology in the general population. Thus, we believe that Down syndrome offers an in vivo model to study the complexity of the pathological events that are central to neurodegeneration and lead to development of early onset Alzheimer's. These events include the genetic fingerprint of oxidative stress embedded into the molecular signature of metabolic defects, a dangerous association for neuronal cells.
Thank you very much, Marcia and Alan. You mentioned briefly, Alan, that there have been some recent discoveries on treatment or targeting amyloid beta. Do you think recent therapeutic strategies sufficiently diminish the clinical roadblock? Or are we really complicated by the serious side effects that patients experience?
I think the issues with lecanemab, which is the first FDA-approved drug that actually is disease-modifying in Alzheimer's disease, is on the right track, in my opinion. It's just not targeting the correct oligomeric state of A-beta. The lecanemab has a number of serious issues. For example, it affects larger oligomers instead of small oligomers. It is only modestly effective, I think 27% slowing of the rate of conversion to dementia. It can lead to brain bleeding, and it is so expensive as to be unavailable to most patients. Moreover, lecanemab treatment has to be accompanied by frequent MRI scans to rule out brain bleeds, and the significant costs of these are not covered usually by U.S. health insurers. So the bottom line is lecanemab may be on the right track, but it does not bind to and inhibit smaller oligomeric A-beta. More research is going to be needed, and lecanemab may point the way to proceed to the worthy goal of developing drugs that inhibit only small oligomers of A-beta. And similarly, rapamycin is highly effective in inhibiting mTORC1, but this would be required for long-term use, and yet unintended consequences of long-term treatment with this mTORC1 inhibitor are not completely understood, and that would have to be addressed.
So just a few words to add, as already pointed by Professor Butterfield, we have few Alzheimer's drugs approved with still restricted benefits because we are treating a multifactorial disease. Further, the complexity of human phenotype is much higher than what we observe in experimental models. And I simply mentioned, because I did, the evaluation of cognitive function, which is very limited in rodent models, while highly complex in humans. So we have the feeling that we identified promising molecular targets, but at some points we fairly observe amelioration of cognitive function. That's why we need a network of different expertises that would help to fill this gap. Further, I would like to share with you how much we can learn from other pathology, sharing common mechanisms with Alzheimer's, which are also considered major risk factor for developing dementia. And they mean cardiovascular pathologies, diabetes, and obesity. Drug repurposing could be one of the strategies of utilizing already approved drugs to treat Alzheimer's. If you remember the initial concern about studying utilization and what we now know about their efficacy, also outside their target, that is cholesterol, that has been designed for, the same could be for many other potential utilized drugs. I take the chance to put your attention on anti-diabetes drugs, which I believe can be promising for future therapies for Alzheimer's.
You mentioned, you know, that animal models of AD and the human disease in terms of cognition impairment are different. And so my question was really very briefly, have the animal models of AD given us significant and sufficient insights into planning preclinical and clinical trials? Or do you think mice are not men and women?
I believe that animal studies are fundamental, at least to clarify the molecular mechanism involved in the neuropathology. And also we can learn a lot by utilizing drugs in order to have a wider comprehensive view of the signaling pathways and the dysfunction of many of the macromolecules we mentioned in our review. The big gap between preclinical and human studies is still something that will require a lot of studies for the future, and mainly in the context of neurodegeneration, exactly for the big gap between the evaluation of cognition in mouse models compared to what we have in humans. And this complexity of the cognitive phenotype of humans due to evolution is something that will require a lot of additional experimental approaches and further studies to be clarified. So I still believe, and I really think that the preclinical studies are a big step needed to set up clinical trials. But of course, the interaction between clinicians and basic scientists to ask each other questions and of course, share criticism is central to make this step forwards.
Thank you very much, Marcia. I think what you have both shown us today is that for basic or clinical scientists to pursue their careers and to dream to become a leading scientist or scientist as you are in neurodegeneration, you've shown them the pathway and how to follow it. You've shown them the enthusiasm, the dedication, and above all, the willingness to collaborate. International laboratories, exchange of students, exchange of postdocs, and as you, I think Alan said, your relationship and collaboration with Marcia has lasted 20, 23 years or something like that. And that shows that really collaboration is a way forward. And I think all young scientists interested in this podcast and neurodegeneration in itself, you've had really a pedigree for how to follow a career. On that note, Alan Butterfield and Marcia Pierluigi, I'd like to thank you on behalf of Physiological Reviews for taking the time from your busy schedule to participate in this podcast. I'd also like to thank our audience for listening to the podcast episode, noting that these podcasts are posted on both our homepage of the journal and via social media. I and my colleagues look forward to our future interactions with you, and I thank you both, Alan and Marcia, for participating today. Many thanks.
Thank you, Giovanni.
Thank you, Giovanni and Cara, for this kind invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. For more episodes like this one, visit journals.physiology.org/journal/physrev or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify.